Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this hour we have another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. In this month's issue, is it still this month? Is it still February? It is this month, isn't it?
Yeah, a couple more days.
I forget. I lose track sometimes. I'm not sure what year or day it is. Is in this issue, it was all about race, and one of the articles that was written in that piece was by a man who's often a guest in this show, by Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. The piece was called White Space, Black Space, Don't Call It Segregation, Making the Case for Separateness. Lester, good to have you in the studio.
Oh, it's good to be back, man. Good to be back.
Join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation with your thoughts and ideas. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And I am interested to see your reaction to this story, your similar stories from both sides of the fence, from all, I say there's more than two sides of this fence. There could be many sides of this cornfield that we can talk about. 410-319-8888. Cornfield. Okay, anyway, so let's
this is going to be hot.
Yeah. let's talk about, just let's outline the story for our listeners. I mean, you talked about moving to Baltimore, and you know that you consciously go out to find a church with a black pastor by choice, and Omega Psi Phi, a black frat by choice, even though you were in a I guess mostly white campus, University of Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you have to go find music, you want to go someplace where they play house music, where it's you, and that's okay. But then you tell us the story about what happened to you at Johns Hopkins University when you went to this affair that the engineering department was putting on, and that's kind of emblematic of your story.
Yeah, so first day of the semester, fall 2008, I was leaving. I taught two classes that day, and I was exhausted, and afterwards I wanted to just get something to drink. So usually at schools like Hopkins and Morgan, you have all these welcome set-outs, right? So they had a welcome set-out with, like, food and drink at the, and like, the patio. Engineering is sponsoring it. So I went up there to get a drink. I asked them, you know, because I knew that I wasn't an engineering student. I knew that I'd get that given the racial makeup of the engineering department, that I'd be the only black person there. I went there, and I asked specifically if I can get a drink. So they said, sure, come on in.
This is a mist you're looking for. A Sierra Mist.
Sierra Mist. Sierra Mist. Like looking specifically drink. For a Sierra Mist. Not just any drink. Sierra Mist.
A glass of wine or beer. Sierra Mist.
Sierra Mist, baby. So they hooked me up, and I was, you know, I was nursing my Sierra Mist, and I was just trying to kind of sort of compose myself because I had a meeting like at 5, and it was at 4. I was just kind of trying to rest and compose myself, and I was there. And at one point in time, while I'm sipping my drink and messing around with stuff in my bag, one of the staff members comes up to me, she tells me that she needs the table I'm using. And because of that, I need to kind of move my stuff, right? Now, I was already about to leave, and I was trying to figure out why she felt that she had to ask me that question, right? I was like, okay, what did you see me doing that caused you to ask me to just move my stuff so I can't use the table? She said, oh, I saw you taking stuff out of your bag like you had planned on staying. And I said, oh, okay, well, what did you see me take out of my bag? Right? Because I was about to leave, right? I was about to leave. And at that point, she got really upset and was really, really rude. And so I said, okay, well, let me talk to your – now, I had two choices at that point. I could either just take it and walk away. I was going to leave anyway. Or I could say something. And I was like, well, no, wait a second. I said, you know, what's your name? So she wouldn't give me her name. I said, well, listen, give me your supervisor, right? Now, at that point, I hadn't told her I was faculty. I didn't think it was important, right? So, you know, I'm getting ready to leave, and I'm just really, really upset about how she treats me. And then the supervisor comes, and this is the thing. Supervisor comes, and at that point, I'm trying to get away, find a way out where we can both save face, right? And I've said, listen, I really appreciate that you guys let me come here. You know, I'm faculty. You know, you guys have done an excellent job. I know that all of our nerves are frayed the first week, but I have to say that your staff member was just really, really, I felt she was really rude to me. And I understand that it's really hard. I understand it's the first week, but she was really rude. And I'm about to leave anyway, but I just thought I'd tell you. So he's listening. He's nodding his head. Then he says, okay, if you don't leave now, we're going to call security. And that's the I said, oh, okay. At that point, I realized, like, they're trying to jam me, right? And I could either, again, I could either leave and take it, or I can stay. So I made a decision to stay, but I'm like, okay, do I stay like I'm from Detroit? Or do I, like, stay, you know, like I'm a faculty member and supposed to be here? So I looked at him. I said, oh, okay, why don't we do this? I'm going to wait over there. You know, and I point it to, like, a little side of the patio so I don't interrupt the student stuff. And you call security. You know, call security, and we'll see what happens. He calls security. And it takes him a while to get there, so long that I call security myself just to verify he actually, in fact, called security, right? Because he could have just been trying to fake me out.
Right.
So, you know, finally they come, and it's two black security officers and one white one. And the first thing I ask is, I said, well, listen, what I want to know is whether they have the right to kick a faculty member out of what's in essence a Johns Hopkins event. That's outside on the patio. Now, if they have the right to kick me out, it doesn't really matter how I felt I was treated or how I was supervised. I was like, if you got a right to kick, I will apologize and go my merry way. And the white security officer was like, what? You mean they kicked you? You're faculty? I was like, yeah. Showed him my ID. Yeah, I'm faculty. They did what? They kicked you out? Yeah. I mean, he's like dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. The two black security officers are like, okay, we kind of know what's going on here. So they like take him to the side and explain to him what they think is going on. And then after that, they have to take a statement from me, and they have to take a statement from the staff person. I overhear the staff person giving them a statement. And what the staff person says is, well, he started raising his voice and making gestures, and I felt threatened. Now, this is racism 101. All right, this is racial profiling 101. And I'm like laughing. I'm like, oh my God, this is like, and I just got finished teaching Introduction to Race and Ethnicity, right? I just got finished talking about this stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is hilarious. But it's not. Right. So I use that story to make a long story short. I actually, you know, the security guards actually chilled me out. The black security officer chilled me out. The white security officer chilled me out. What I said in the original draft of the story, but it didn't make it in the final copy, is the dean of the School of Engineering, who's white himself, actually emailed me and apologized. But the thing is what I want to use that story to talk about is how even in a I feel very comfortable at Hopkins. I love working at Hopkins, love the students, love the staff, love the faculty, et cetera. But even there, it's like there's always this implicit threat where power can be deployed and you can, in effect, be racialized. You can be rendered the other where they don't really have to listen to you. They don't have to acknowledge your power. They don't have to acknowledge your role, and they can jack you. And for that, you need black spaces. Or, you know, for in my case, because I'm African American, I need spaces where there's a whole host of things I have to worry about, but that's not one of them. And that's what the story is about.
So there's a lot of layers here. I mean, I was thinking about this today, and really not about the show as much. Then it started popping in my head that I was thinking about the show. That I was looking at these this continuing to statistics about America, about this divide, 47, 46, believe this, don't believe that, mm-hmm. and how it's tied in some ways around this vote between Obama and McCain, though it really isn't about either of those two men explicitly. It might, you know, they might have voted for them, but it has... There are so many more variables that force people on either side of that divide that have nothing to do with being a Democrat or Republican or either one of those people. And that a lot has to, and then I was thinking about all the people who I've been interviewing this week who represent this generation that, I don't want to say going beyond race, but represents this generation that's younger, that is more comfortable with race and going beyond a lot of the things that older people have still mess up with, as does, I think, a lot of the American population, a good half of the American population. Maybe more of that in terms of the white population. 50 or 60% of the white population is still in that old place, let's say. And people have made obvious advancements. I mean, you're a professor at Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
But so this is where the complexity, we're in a very strange place with all that right now, you know, and that's why I found the story you told so interesting, because at the same time, we're in a place that seems to be moving towards a new direction. There clearly still has to be a place for place, different than when, let's say, the Afro-American newspaper was founded and you had to have a black newspaper because there'd be no black voice without a black newspaper,
yeah.
Right? But we're in a place now where it's still relevant, but for different reasons.
Yeah, that's right. So one way to think about it is that so America is an ongoing, it's a work in progress, right? And you've got these orders, right, that exist at a given moment or in a specific time. So, for example, we could think about a Jim Crow order that exists from approximately like 1890 or so to like 1960 or so, right? And then you've got an order before that and an order after it, right? And in this case, maybe a couple of orders after it. But the stuff that's in a given order, even after a new order is in place, some of that old stuff is still there, right? Because this is dynamic. It's a process that moves across space and across time, right? So in this case, again, you know, I'm really comfortable. I think I'm different than even my predecessors at Hopkins, and that I'm actually really comfortable at Hopkins, right? So I make the white space, black space thing a lot more stark than what it really is for me, just for the purpose of the article. But I feel really comfortable in that space.
But
there is this stuff that's embedded from the previous order, right, where that supervisor, when I'm encountering that supervisor, he doesn't think to ask me for ID, and he moves immediately to the threat. If you don't leave, I'm calling security, right? And that's a deployment of power that's really a fundamental aspect of previous orders.
And part of that has to do with being perceived clearly as a black man, but not with how some people envision how a professor who is black should look at Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. So one of the really, I got some really thoughtful feedback, and one of the best critical pieces, it was a person who was basically arguing that he said it wasn't race. It was probably the way you carried yourself, and it's possible that you were really, really rude to the staff member she felt put upon, right? And he's actually, in one way, he's right, in that there's it's simple to say it was just that I was black. But the thing is that threat, so what I had to walk him through like a series of assumptions. So let's assume that faculty members in general are asses, because on college campuses, they tend to feel very high about themselves, right? They have a great deal of privilege. Let's assume also that staff members are routinely put, particularly female staff members, are routinely put upon. They're routinely treated as if they're less than, often by faculty members, right? So something like this has most likely happened before. But if given that's the case, when I ask the security guard, can you kick a faculty member out of a faculty member's event? He should be able to say, well, yeah, because something like this has had to have happened before. And the supervisor has had to have put a faculty member in his place. And that faculty member has had to have acted out, because faculty members tend to act like asses, right? But you can't explain that, right? So the only thing that explains the fact that he called a security on me, and that when I talked to security, they had no record of anything like that ever have happened before, it can only be explained by the fact that I'm black. So yeah, I could have acted like an ass. Yeah, I could have. All that stuff and race come together, right? It comes together. So my carriage as an African American, my carriage as a faculty member, all that stuff wraps up in this case, it leads to one very specific consequence.
Let me open the phones here, and we're going to talk about we're talking with Dr. Lester Spence, Johns Hopkins University, about his article "White Space, Black Space," that appeared in the February issue of Urbanite. This is one of our Urbanite Radio stories. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Michael, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Michael.
Michael Carter, and I am a psychologist, and like your guest, I attend the University of Michigan. However, I played the right fraternity. I played the Alpha, so we won't go there.
Oh, Epsilon chapter, huh?
Exactly.
What year?
Oh, not in, I'm not telling you that. You don't need to know that. It was a long time ago. But really quickly, after I, when I got my PhD from Hopkins, and I'll give you that year, 1988, the head of my department came to me, and he congratulated me because I did really well in school. And he said, Michael, I want to tell you one thing. Congratulations for what you've done. And I want to ask you a question. I said, what's that, sir? He said, what do you call a black man with a PhD? And I said, what's that, sir? And he said, nigga. And he didn't mean it negatively. He just wanted me to understand where I was and where I am. And through my life and through my career, many, many times I've had people question me about my credentials, or people come to my office and say, well, you just sound like a black person on the phone. And I go, oh, really? Well, surprised. So I say, oh, let's just say, young man, you know, I'm going to read your article. I haven't read it yet. All we are, first and foremost, what they see is our color. Forget what we've done. Forget what we achieved. But remember, all they see is our color. And we've made it in spite of, not because of. So I'm going to get off the phone and listen to you guys. Keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, yeah. That's all right. Epsilon Chapter Alpha. That's all right. So this is where I'd say. I agree that the reason I'm here is because of a long history of protest and struggle, actually at the University of Michigan. So let's say he pledges in the mid-70s. There's the Black Action Movement, the Second Black Action Movement. I'm a direct product of that Second Black Action Movement that happens like around 77 at University of Michigan. Where I would disagree is that, and this is part of that change order, is that what they call me is doctor, right? So and I don't actually... That's the first time.
Who's they?
The assumption is whites.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is actually the first time I've had an encounter like that, like ever. Now, at Hopkins, before Johns Hopkins, I was at Washington University in St. Louis. Now, I wouldn't make the claim that these places are hospitable to African Americans at all. Even though I really like Hopkins, I like being at WashU. But there is a subtle shift in that the students. You know, I got an excellence in teaching award, and I read most of the letters that were written for me, and there were only a couple of African Americans who wrote, right? I mean, these are white kids who are like, oh my God, this guy changed my life, right? So at the same time, racism is alive and well. At the micro level, that is between individuals, there's a lot more space for openness and understanding than there was when Mike got his PhD in 88, which was the year after I came to Michigan and the year before I pledged.
So, but at the same time, I'll take a little switch and come back to where we were and take it somewhere else in a little bit. But you also write in the article how you consciously chose a neighborhood in Pikesville that was entirely or predominantly African American. It was formerly Jewish, now African American. Mm. A middle class, upper middle class black neighborhood, as opposed to like picking a place that it was either mostly white, or if you want to pick a place that's really multiracial, you'd have to pick a working class neighborhood. There aren't too many upper middle class neighborhoods that are multiracial, which I find interesting.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Other than Columbia, maybe, but so talk about that.
Yeah. So and before I lived in Ashburton, right? So it was like
lived in Ashburton when you first came to Baltimore.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So part of that was about being in a place where, to the extent I had to deal with that thing, that I didn't have to deal with that. I could just come and just talk, you know, just breathe, right? Just, and that's the language I use. So even given how much I like Hopkins, how much I like WashU before, how much I love Michigan, right? There's a sense where in these spaces we can't, it's not like we're performing necessarily. I mean, I'm not fake. I don't quite roll like that, right? I couldn't be fake if I wanted to. But it's idea that I have to kind of be on, I'm representing something bigger than myself. Right. So everywhere I can't, there's not a place I can go on Hopkins where people don't know who I am. Whereas if I'm in that space, or if I'm with my fraternity brothers, or if I'm back home in Detroit, I'm just a guy.
So one of the ways that the issue of race is still very prevalent in America, and racism and racial thinking, and not just a racist thing, but racial thinking and racial consciousness is very prevalent in our country, despite everything that they be changing or not changing, is the fact that somebody who is not white, but especially people who are, let's say, African American or some Latinos and some Native Americans, when you're not when you are in, when you are the one, or the two, or
yeah,
the three,
yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Then it's not you, the individual. People are forced to represent,
yeah,
even
that's
if
right.
that's not what somebody wants to do.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
So how does, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So in that case, I'm representing the race, right? So there are like maybe 10 black faculty members on Hopkins campus at Homewood, and every time I go, it's like I have to represent.
So 10? That's all?
Yeah, I could like name them, right? And everywhere I go, I have to represent. And because I've been representing since Michigan, you know, I've got literally 20 years at this, right? So now it's kind of normal. But when I go home, I don't have to represent that, right? I could just, like I said, I could just be one in the multitude, right? And now granted, that has its own challenges. But, you know, I don't have to necessarily worry about being one or being extra, extra visible, right? Or in that case, when I'm dealing with this, I'm really cognizant of my language, of how I was really intense because I was upset. But I was like, man, I gotta speak the King's English. I can't cuss nobody out. I can't I can't even threaten, you know. There's all types of things I can't do. I have to be really, really careful because if I do the wrong thing, I'm gonna be jacked, right? And I don't have to worry about, well, I don't have to worry about that type of thing when I'm in predominantly black spaces. And non-whites don't in general when they're in predominantly non-white spaces.
And you say whites don't when they're in non-white spaces?
I said non-whites don't have to worry about
right,
that when they're
space,
in non-white
right.
spaces.
Folks, I'm sorry.
Although I got a number of interesting emails from whites who have to deal with that in Baltimore spaces, right? Where they're the only white and they have to kind of.
Right, let's get our listeners joined here. Let's talk about the complexities of this together. We're here with Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, who wrote White Space, Black Space in this month's issue of The Urbanite. This is one of our Urbanite radio stories and conversations. Number is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So I'm curious about how you respond to what Lester was talking about in terms of having to represent, in terms of the kind of. How we confront race maybe differently in the 21st century in different spaces than we did in the 20th century, how just the nature of who we are and where we are is changing in some ways and what that means. I mean, and does it mean, let's say, what Lester just pointed out, that if you're white in a mostly black space, what is that? And how does that? Maybe you're not representing white, but something else is going on that's not every day. And how many of us run back to our spaces? I mean, there's a reason why most Jews in America live in Jewish communities. Maybe I articulate it as going back to your own space, but it's going back to your own space. And I remember in the 60s, a group called the Young Patriots in Chicago, who were Appalachian whites, who were organizing their brand of the Black Panther Party, but they called themselves the Young Patriots. And they said, look, no, we're not like everybody else. We have our own space because... You know, my culture is unique as an Appalachian. It's different. I'm comfortable with my own, but I want to be with everybody else. So here we are, America, 21st century, 410-319-8888, here with Mark Steiner and Dr. Lester Spence. Gary in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm 56 years old, so I have so many stories that I could pull out. Thinking while the young man was talking.
Well, we're close to the same age, Gary, so go ahead. I got
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I know you're a little older than I am, Mark.
I'm not older, man. No. You're older than I am, but we're close.
as the young man was talking, I said, well, you know, I'm going to go back to the University of Pennsylvania that I attended. I didn't graduate, but I attended. And I was on leave of absence. I had... played some football. I heard the man say he was a sports guy. And I was on a leave of absence for academic and an injury, academic reasons and an injury that I had gotten playing football the previous season. So I was at a football game, and I had just been operated on. My shoulder had just been operated on. My arm was in a sling. And we were, like, knocking this big ball around, little big balloons, you know, the fans in the stands were knocking it around, and I look back, and the blacks, you know, we normally sat kind of together because we were very much in the minority, even though it was the largest percentage of blacks my class was up until that time and since. My class was 75. And so this white guy takes something sharp and busts my balloon, right? Jamie, Chris, what's wrong with this guy? So what I do, and this was in the second half, so after the game, I'm like, look, man, you know, that was my balloon. You know, I saw you busted. Can you at least give me my money? And he's like, you know, I'm not going to give you anything. You know, I guess he was like, you know, this is my territory. This is Pennsylvania. This is University of Pennsylvania, Franklin Field, right? And so he called me a black B-I-T-C-H. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And so I took my jacket off. I was like, man, I'm not taking this from anybody.
Yeah, it's on.
You know, and the guy put his guard up. Now, here's one, you know, I'm a pretty big guy, but I still only had one arm. And so he put his hands up, and luckily, you know, I knocked this guy down, and then I got on top of him, and I pummeled him a few times to make sure he stayed down. And then one of his friends, I'll never forget this, his friend goes, he hit him when he was down, you know?
Like, that's not fair.
So, all right, but
what we're talking about here, even though I didn't get arrested or anything,
yeah,
you know, we're talking about, again, white privilege. You know, they can say anything they want to say to us. Mm. Almost at any time, and even though that happened all the way back in the fall of 1973, it's almost like an episode of post-traumatic stress disorder for me. I can remember it crystal clear,
yeah.
And I'll let your other callers chime in, and I got to read your article, no question. So take good care. Talk to you guys later.
Gary, thanks so much. We're going to take a break here, but I was interested in a show we did last week. A man was talking about his stories about the first time we crossed the line about race, and it's going to be a series we're going to do in the air over and over again. Maybe we'll add this conversation to it, because I think these are conversations we need to kind of keep and save and put out there to increase this conversation. Yeah. But one of the things he talked about was being the only Jewish kid at Pimlico Jewish Junior High School when it used to be a white Jewish school mostly, then it was mostly Jewish and white, then it was a mixed school, and then it became a mostly black school. With very few white or Jewish kids there.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the cartoon I remember came out years and years back, and I had two frames in it. And it was about urban America back in the early 70s. And the one frame was these white kids chasing black kids down the street. The next frame was black kids chasing white kids down the street.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because their power equations shift on a very personal level. You know, and levels that you have to be honest about to talk about to kind of unearth what it really means.
Yeah, it's really complicated, right? So, and at least one emailer, I had to kind of he was really upset because he was in a same sex relationship, but it was same sex biracial. So he was white, his partner was black, and what he was asking, he was like, "Wow, are you saying that every time we're together, I'm exerting power over my partner? You know, is there any way out of it?" And I said, "Well, listen, there's a difference between interpersonal, between the micro politics, that is the politics of an interpersonal relationship, right, and power, right, and macro politics when that police officer's called." So we can easily imagine circumstances in which white kids have to deal with being beat up by black kids because they're the only one in the neighborhood. But it's very difficult to imagine a circumstance where somebody black can say, "Okay, if you don't get out of here, we're going to call the police on you," to somebody who's white. Yeah, I mean, that's a different level. When you got power deployed like that, that puts it in another category.
Let's take a very brief break. We'll be right back with Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University. His article is White Space, Black Space in this month's Urbanite, which we're talking about. Another one of our Urbanite radio stories. Alex from Mandelstown and Eleanor in Baltimore, Veronica in White Marsh. We're going to come to you lickety-split 1, 2, and 3 to get you on the air with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite talks about race in Baltimore with stories about the quest for diversity, the history of segregation, and why Baltimoreans still lead separate lives. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. You can visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll come right back with Dr. Lester Spence and your comments. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by the law offices of Sandra Martin Douglas, offering yesterday's work ethic in today's legal world through quality representation and sound legal advice in criminal family law and criminal family and personal injury legal matters. To schedule a consultation, 410-685-6181 or online at smdlawoffices.com. That's smdlawoffices.com. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And as I said, we're joined in studio. It's one of our Urbanite Radio specials by Dr. Lester Spence, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, author of the article in this month's issue called White Space, Black Space. You can find him at lesterspence.com to read his writings. You can also follow him on Twitter at Lester Spence. 410-319-8880 is the number. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. As I promised, write to the phones in the order I said earlier. And Alex in Randalltown, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Alex. Welcome.
I'm a longtime listener. I'm a huge fan. I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
Just to give you a little background on me, I'm a refugee from Ukraine. I'm a Ukrainian Jew. I've lived in the United States. It was actually just 20 years, this December 9th.
Mm-hmm.
The issues that I find that boggle my mind, in my country, back at home, which is actually, I could not be considered a Russian or a Ukrainian, and I was looked down on because I was a Jew. Now, I did not stand out because I was black or any other color. We all looked the same. Nevertheless, we received just as much prejudice as the blacks receive in America, and if not more. We had our houses burned. We had the women raped. And this goes back centuries, back to the Jews' exit out of the, Israel.
Right.
Back to the Exodus. But my issue is not only the separatism of cultures in America, since this is supposed to be the melting pot. What I find difficult to understand is black people in particular, and please don't take this the wrong way.
Just say it. Sorry.
I do have a huge amount of black friends, and I'm just trying to understand the politics. So when something boggles me, that's an issue for American blacks. It's something that I go to my friends and I ask, because I don't understand.
Okay.
And I ask on a level that they can explain it to me. So what boggles me is not only the prejudice that I see on behalf of the black Americans towards anyone else that approaches them. It's something that looks like, to my eyes, it's something that I see black Americans actually taking a pride in, not only standing out, but standing out to the point that, it's not I'm black and I'm proud. It's something like, I'm black and I'm proud, and the rest of y'all, can kiss my shiny black ass, which is great.
And we got to watch the language on the radio here, everybody, because it is a family radio station. Go ahead.
I understand. And what that creates is, a line, a line between the black people and everyone else. So that kind of, if people want to be accepted and at the same time creating a line, everyone here is different. Everyone here is different. So beating your chest and saying that I'm black is great. But at the same time, you can't put anybody else down. Everybody else is people here. I see, black Americans putting down Africans who are their brothers. They come here, they're at the flea market. They're trying to make some money. And here comes some, hoodlums out of, Glen Burnie. And, go back to Africa type deal. And I don't understand how can a black man put another black man down.
Okay.
And call himself, an African-American.
And Alex, just in the interest of time only, because there are a bunch of callers behind you want to get on with their thoughts as well. Let's just wrestle with what you were saying for a moment.
Real quick. So, when I meet you in person, I imagine I'm going to meet you in person sometime or another. I'm going to actually clown you hard for talking about how all your friends are black. So like, but it's going to be out of love. So I'm going to, I had to put that out there. Like, all my friends are black. There is a real, what we have to think about is about citizenship claims, right? So what is it that a citizen of America should respect, should expect as a citizen? Should I have to, like, and so taking that instance where somebody's messing with me at Hopkins, it's like, I shouldn't have to act right. I should have to be lawful, but I shouldn't have to act right to be given the respect that a Hopkins citizen gets, right? So I understand that African, so even if everything you say is right, that African Americans are random and trifling, that sometimes they treat Africans bad, that sometimes they're discriminatory against whites, none of that, even if that were accurate, we are citizens. So none of that should in any way justify the deployment of power in ways that rob blacks of the same opportunity to live and thrive as other racial groups, right? And in fact, given their long history of subjugation, just as the Jews experienced in Russia, what one would expect naturally that there'd be some type of counter movement that would affirm black humanity. Now, sometimes that gets out of hand, yes, but that move should be readily understood, particularly from somebody who comes from a group with a long history of being oppressed.
Alex, thanks so much for your call. I'm glad you raised the issues you raised. And I just want to make a quick comment, then we're going to go to our next caller, Eleanor and Veronica and Mario. We're going to come to all three of you right away here. But that we have perceptions of the other in America. They come from very deep places. And I think that I'm thinking that, you know, there are a lot of people in America, a lot of people in America who are not Jewish. Most people in America are not Jewish. It's a minority in America, a small one. But if you live in Baltimore, you think there are a lot of Jews in the world, but there really aren't. It's like if you live in Baltimore, you think there are a lot of black folks in the world, and there aren't. But the reality is that people can look at behavior in a Jewish community that would seem normal, like raising your voice, like being loud, like heated discussions. You go to a home or my home come for dinner and people are up and you're yelling and they're screaming. But it's not anger. Nobody's threatened. But that can be very threatening to, and becomes the stereotype of who these people are. Yeah. And I think we have these things in our head that what seems like confrontation, like a black man can walk into a place most like white like you did in a very innocent way, and it immediately is seen as confrontation, as your friend wrote in the article when you described the woman who worked at the public defender's office, and she said to you in the article, when you went to talk to her about what happened, she beat you to the punch by telling you that, they said that you were, she said, let me guess, she said, you were making furtive gestures and that she felt threatened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's these lines that we still haven't learned how to cross.
Yeah. There are these sets of cultural practices that we have to somehow create a space where people can understand where they come from and feel free to be allowed to express them.
Right.
Again, without necessarily being put down by the police.
I'll give you one more quick thing. We're going to write the phones. Like, you can't see this in the air, folks, but there are cultural mannerisms people have, whether you're black, whether you're Chinese, whether you're Japanese, whether you're Appalachian, whether you're Jewish, whoever you are. And there are some things, you know, I noticed that some people, like, there's a thing in the Jewish community where you physically will take your hand like this. I have my hand at the side of my head. Somebody's talking to you, and you flap your hand down. Ah, man, please. Ah. So people see that as dismissive, derisive, but no. It's just, that's what it is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But, you know, you see that people,
is he playing
me?
Yeah.
Is he dismissive?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, so those kind of things really do exist.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
That's absolutely right.
410-319-8888. Eleanor, you're on the air.
I just want to commend you on what you're doing there at Johns Hopkins University, and keep on doing what you're doing and being yourself who you are. I had the opportunity to work at the Johns Hopkins Club as a membership coordinator. And when I entered that facility on campus, I was not shocked, but I'm 40 years old. A lot I haven't seen and understood and paid attention to, and getting a degree and getting in the corporate world and understanding what's going on. But I was really shocked in what took place. The membership club didn't have African Americans registered in their club.
Mm-hmm.
And as a membership coordinator, me being quote unquote the coordinator, my first initiation was to enroll all African Americans who had graduated from Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah.
And given them opportunities to do what everyone else here is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to go quote unquote black, white, and all this, but that's a big issue all by itself, and that's going to be here till Jesus comes. But I just want to commend you on what you're doing and keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much, sister. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the work you do. I mean, I like the Hopkins Club a lot, but I know the dynamics you're talking about.
It'd be interesting. I just thought about this. One of my oldest friends in life is a guy named Fletcher Roberts, who now works at the New York Times. He's been there for a while. But he graduated from Hopkins back in 64.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's old school.
I should have just called. Fletcher would have told me to shut up. I'm not coming here. I should have called him and asked him anyway.
That would have been hot.
Yeah, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Veronica in White Marsh. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to tell Dr. Spencer, I read his article. I thought it was very good. I read it a couple of weeks ago. But I'm a graduate of and attended two predominantly white universities in Georgia. And so I don't know if my experience is because these schools were in Georgia and it's the South, or it's because these were predominantly white universities. But there are so many, I don't even know what to call them. I guess I felt like a lot of times I was being treated unfairly, and my white classmates would just say, I was only African-American in my class, they would just say, oh, you have to brown nose, you have to brown nose. And I would say, well, I didn't even know what brown nosing was. Yeah. What do you mean brown nose, you know?
Yeah.
I speak to everybody. I'm friendly. I'm not, you know, I don't sit and talk in class. And I remember there was one incident in particular in the program I was in. They had a summer class that entered in the summer where they took just 12 students, and that was my class. And then the class that would come in the fall every year took 40 students. And this one professor had a list of the prospective students, the 40 that were coming in. And she went down the whole list, and by each person by name, she knew something about. And, you know, she'd say, oh, Susie Robertson, good family. Her father's a lawyer, her mother's a homemaker, good family, mm-hmm. Christian girl. Yeah. You know, Judy Bloom, oh, nice family. Grandmother wrote the Constitution, you know, grandfather started the police department. Nice family, nice family. Jermaine Breeze, she's a black girl. Oh, here we have Linda Norman, good family. Car dealership. And then she got to the second student. Jackie Foster, she's a black girl, and she went the whole list, all 40 students.
Yeah.
The two African-American students that were coming, all she said was, she's a black girl.
Yeah.
So this was like 20 years ago when you were in college?
Yeah, I graduated in 88.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was seething, and I said nothing, and my white classmates, it even bothered them, and they came to me later, they said, you know, she was trying to make you feel comfortable. I said, how was she trying to make me feel comfortable?
Yeah.
Well, she was just letting you know that, hey, come fall, there will be two more African-Americans on campus. And I said, and she knew nothing else about them except that they were African-American.
Yep.
Well, as she called them, a black girl. But every other student, to a name, she knew the mother, the father. In some cases, she knew what the grandparents did.
Right.
What town in Georgia or Florida they were from. And I'm so angry about it. It seemed like a little thing to some people. I'm so angry about it.
Yeah.
22 years later, I'm 2 seconds away from finding her email address or finding her on Facebook and writing her and telling her, if you thought you were making me feel comfortable, you know, your racist attitude did no such thing.
Yeah.
And well, every time I get my alumni letter, you know, I hesitate putting that money in an envelope just because I think of stuff that was done, you know, during my time there.
Lester?
I mean, so real quick, I'm at the point now, I'm wise enough now that I know that unless I give money to Michigan, that there won't be other Lester Spences or Sean. My wife went to Michigan also. There won't be Sean Spences or Michael Robinsons, right? But at the same time, it's like, yeah, these events, they cut us, right? So this event, I was able to purge myself because I was able to put it out there in the Urbanite, but I carried that with me for a while. I mean, even thinking about it, as I'm thinking about it now, it's taking me right back there, right? And it's like, man, they didn't see anything. They didn't hear any of the words that were coming from my mouth. The first thing was, I'm calling the police. Like, what the hell, right? Like, I'm supposed to be here, you know? And it's really unfortunate that most of us who attend predominantly white institutions or live in integrated spaces have a story like that.
Thank you so much for the call, Veronica. I'm glad you're part of this, Veronica. 410-319-8888. Mario in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Much props to you, Dr. Spence, definitely. I wanted to comment on one of the things that you had said, and I wrote it down. I think you said you felt like you should have been lawful, but you should not have to have acted right at some point when that situation happened. To me, that took me back to a conversation that I have that I've had several times with my sister, on and on about how they're, and I've grown to accept this. No offense to you at all, Mark. I love your show, long time listener, but I've grown to a point where honestly, and I'm an African American male. I'm in the healthcare industry. I'm a clinician. Mm-hmm. I've grown to a point where I've accepted the fact that in order for me to really function and thrive in this country, amongst predominantly whites in any institution in any capacity, I have to view even whites as a science.
As a what?
And so I've grown to teach even my cousin as a science.
As a science.
As a science. In order for me, like you said, you made a comment. I should not have to act right in some way. So that assumes that there is a right way to act. So whatever way you were acting, like you said, is somehow associated with a certain profile, a certain behavior type, mm-hmm. a certain race, possibly. And sure enough, it is. So I've gotten to the point where I'm saying, I was telling my sister, because she kept, you know, wondering, well, how come my English teacher would never give me good grades? And I looked at her papers when I came home from college and listened. I'm like, oh, well, you're writing the way you talk. So what do you mean? Right. I'm like, well, you're not writing, you're not proving that you can utilize the English language the way they want you to, although you don't do it in your day-to-day talk. So there is a science to how you're going to have to maneuver and navigate in this society. You mm-hmm. have to dress a certain way, talk mm-hmm. a certain way. Your hair, it's sad to say it, but in many instances has to look a certain way. I myself used to have dreadlocks. I went to Hopkins for about 5 months. Unfortunately, through a really bad experience, and I'll be brief, this was not at the university, but at the hospital, Johns Hopkins Hospital. I relocated from Portland, Oregon, originally came all this way, moved all my stuff, went there for about 5 months, and I was told that I threaten and intimidate the residents. I lack critical thinking skills, and I would never make a great clinician. I had 30 minutes to decide if I would either resign or have my name falsely reported to the Maryland Board of Physicians. And that really
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. 16 days later, and again, I think that when that happened to me, it broke me spiritually, because I got to the point where I was like, okay, God, I'm ready to sign up and say that I am, quote-unquote, a racist. Because I said to myself, I ruled everything out. I said, no, it couldn't have been the race car. Can't be that. I got here on my own merit. I applied. I interviewed. I flew over here to interview. They saw me. They knew my record. They knew my credentials.
Right.
I flew over here. And if I indeed endangered patient lives, or if I indeed was a threat or, you know, non-compliant with residents, or if I indeed was a poor critical thinker, why would they allow me to continue to be so around patients day to day, hour to hour, for 5 continuous months?
So what how long ago was this?
This was in 2006.
2000.
This is in 2006. Yeah. And 16 days later, thankfully, I did find a job. They doubled my salary and paid my rent. So it was definitely a blessing. But again, I'm going back to my original point, but I've grown to a point, you know, what you said just really, really made me think about the conversation that I had with my sister before she graduated. She's actually now at Morgan, works on your radio station, but we had a conversation about how there is a science to how you're going to have to maneuver and navigate, you know, in this society. Yep. And I said to my coworker over and over, you know, Rudy, you are the science. And he never figured out what I was talking about. But honestly, for me to have peace in my day-to-day walk and work, that is how I go and function. I look at Caucasians and the Eurocentric mindset, the Eurocentric ways of life, as a science, and I must learn it. I must study it. I must learn it and be proficient in it in order to function and operate in the society. I let it go.
Mario, thank you so much. I'm glad you got through.
Yeah, wow. That's a story, right?
That's a story. We're gonna have to make a transcript out of this show.
Yeah, straight up.
And I would also just go another call here, and I'm going to encourage anybody who is listening, Mario and the rest, who would just like to write me so I can get more in touch and get more in depth with the stories that people are telling.
And holler at me, too.
Just go to Mark, M-A-R-C, at Steiner Show, org, and I'll get right back to you, or go to letsjustspence.com. 410-319-8888. We only have a few minutes left here. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I want to start off by saying I really appreciate conversations like this. I think it's really important for people to openly and honestly talk about race.
Mm-hmm.
And to start, I'm just going to start with something that happened to me over the summer. I am a white woman living in Baltimore City, and I'm constantly aware of being white. And this is something that is a newer experience for me. So being just somebody who's always trying to understand their identity, it's something that I always think about and think about ways that I can understand what it means to be a white woman. Well, I was at the parking authority, and it was probably about 9:30 in the morning, and the Ricky Smiley morning show was on, and there were a couple other people, and I was the only white woman. And a song came on that was just really crazy and not morning time music, and everyone was just like, "Oh, this is ridiculous," and I was like, "Yeah, it is." And then another one of the women looked at me and said, "Yeah, even the white woman thinks it's crazy," and she wasn't saying it in any kind of negative way necessarily.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it made me think, like, "Oh yeah, I am the white woman." And at first I was kind of offended because I was like, I listen to the Ricky Smiley morning show. Like, I live in Baltimore City. How come this can't be a space where I'm fully accepted and I just kind of blend in? But it can't be, and it won't be. And I'm always constantly going to be aware of being white. And I say this, and I called in just to say, I think it's important for people to understand who they are and understand, just how their background plays in to their life.
Linda, I deeply appreciate what you called and said. Lester, what are you thinking? Real fast, we have about 60 seconds.
Yeah, that's a great story, and I think that there are a number. Just like in some ways, men should step in women's shoes to see what types of lives they're leading, right? I think that it's a blessing that it would be a blessing if more whites could actually live and try to thrive and survive in environments where they're the only one and they have to kind of deal with some of the stuff that we deal with.
Now, I wish we had time to take all these other callers coming in, but we do have to break here, and I apologize for that. Only in the sense I apologize because this is such an important discussion, and the one we had last week was similar, but it was different when we talked about stoop stories in people's conversations about when they first crossed the color line in America and what that was like for them from all sides and what that experience was. And this just says to me that I think that these are the kind of discussions that we need to focus on all the time on the air, and we will, as a regular part of our conversation on different levels, bringing people like Dr. Lester Spence and others in to help us through these conversations. Thank you all for calling and making the show what it is. And Dr. Lester Spence, thank you for being in the studio, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, my man. Thanks for reading, too. I appreciate it.
Yeah, always good seeing you. Read Dr. Lester Spence's article in The Urbanite, White Space, Black Space. Check him out at lesterspence.com, and you can Twitter him at Lester Spence. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Another brush with adolescence. I'll be right back.